So this time we are talking about sharks. Eve, thanks for the introduction. My name is Mason Dean. This could also just be simply called Fish Part 2. This is the other group of fish. And as Ron said before, these are multi-collaborative works, and I've worked with a bunch of people on these projects. I try to mention them as I go along, but in case I forget some, here are a few of them listed here. So Ron spent some time explaining to you the differences between fish skeletons and mammalian skeletons. And there's apparently some strong diagnostic differences in the way that bone behaves in the different groups. But also just within fishes, there is a really impressive split in the types of skeletal tissues that you see. I'll just go through this really quickly, but geologic time here is going from left to right. These are mostly extinct groups of fishes, with some of these extending up into modern day forms. And if we just try a sort of ham-handed approach to map different skeletal tissues onto this phylogeny here, we see that a lot of the earlier tissues were a mineralized type of cartilage, but then there was a sort of pivot point around here where there was a branch towards bony fishes and towards the elasmobranchs and the holocephalon fishes, which all have cartilaginous skeletons. So there's a point at which many of fishes actually had some degree, or appears had some degree of bone at different parts of their skeleton, but the elasmobranch fishes, the sharks and rays and their relatives, shifted toward a lineage that has a particular type of cartilage. So Ron spoke about the bony fishes, but today I'm just going to be going pretty quickly through a sort of smorgasbord of individual data bits about this main other group of fishes here. So cartilage as a primary skeletal material, if you look at it from a mammalian perspective, seems like a horrible idea. Peter, that was you, right, wagging your nose up front. We normally think of cartilage as a filler, a contour filler, like in our ears or our nose, as a bearing surface or as a scaffold that's, through ontogeny, eventually completely replaced by bone, which makes it seem like maybe cartilage plays a second fiddle to bone as a skeletal material. You can see here in a cleared and stained backbone of a fish, blue is cartilage, red is bone. As the animal ages, you see that everything that was cartilaginous here is completely replaced by red tissue, the bone. If we then put that into, again, one of these stolen material spaces from Vicks and Ashby, here's unmineralized cartilage down here, stiffness on the y-axis. Although it's a low density material compared to bone, it doesn't even compare as far as stiffness goes, and this is a logarithmic scale on the y. The trick, though, and Peter took my punchline a little bit in some ways, is that there's a unique morphology relating to the mineralization of this tissue. If we look at the inside of a shark here with this schematic that I've drawn of all the skeletal elements ranging through the body, everything in green is what I'll call tessellated cartilage. So if we take the head of a shark here and we take a cross section through its jaw, this looks a lot like some of those sandwich structures we were talking about before. This is a cross section of the skeletal element. Every bit around the outside here is a mineralized tissue. On the inside is an unmineralized core, a gel-like unmineralized cartilage. I can draw a schematic of it here. These are mineralized blocks called tesserae. They're like individual tiles sitting on top of a gel-like core and overlain by a fibrous perichondrium that's like a type 1 collagen. If we look at then the surface of a skeletal element, you see that really it does look like tiling, like the tiling you'd see on the floor of a bathroom or something. And we can reduce this down to just this generalized schematic that I think Peter showed as well, with these tiles in this sort of surface aspect view here, but in cross-section, you see an array of hexagonal blocks joined together by fibrous material and sitting on an uncalcified cartilage. So you see also that this isn't just a flat surface tiling material. It can form some pretty complex shapes. And if we look at a few radiographs of rays, in this case, rays and skates, we see that there's a huge range of body forms that can result from this. Again, here's a CT scan of a huge range of different ecologies, different body sizes, all formed by this type of mineralized cartilage. The other thing is the performance aspect of this. Keep in mind, like usually all the animals that we see, all the mammals we see videos of doing impressive bouts of performance typically have bony skeletons when they're moving quickly or experiencing large forces. All these animals here, for instance, have cartilaginous skeletons. And as many of you know from probably watching the Discovery Channel, sharks and rays, they're some of the biggest fish in the ocean. They can move incredibly fast. They're some of the fastest swimmers, but can also move their skeletons incredibly rapidly in ballistic bouts of jaw protrusion, like in this electric ray that protrudes its jaw about 100% of its head length in about 100 milliseconds or less to suck worms up out of the sand, or this jaw protrusion in the sand tiger shark there. But then also they can exert extremely large forces, either through bite forces feeding on fish or for crushing mollusks, or in this case, this rapid movement here that generates a single subambient bout of pressure for sucking food into the throat. So, we know now a bit about the mineralization of the tissue. What we still have zero concept about, actually, is how the tiling happens in the first place. In adults, we see this beautiful tiling pattern that really, for the most part, is perfect hexagonal tiles coming together. And we know from a short study we did on a certain species of stingray that the cartilage starts off as a cell-rich, unmineralized cartilage, but then there is some kind of magic step here where suddenly the tiling appears, and we have no idea what's happening there. What happens after that, though, is relatively clear. If we plot disc width, which is just a measure of the age of the animal, so you can imagine these animals here going from left to right, from the point that those tesserae form, they continue to increase in their dimensions as the animals get older. How they increase in dimensions is kind of an important point. It might seem like a simple thing to say, yes, they're tiles and the tiles are increasing in size. But if you think about it, this is cartilage, which is an avascular, aneural material that can't repair. So as a result, it can't remodel any of the mineralized material that's in there. If you had a system with an unmineralized cartilage here with a continuous rind on the outside versus this tessellated version we have, if you wanted to grow that structure, in this case, this is the only option you have, just accreting the mineral on the outside. And so gradually, this ratio between the unmineralized and mineralized material is going to change drastically, and I'll show you in a second why that's important. In the tessellated version, though, as long as you can deposit material at the edges of the tiles, you can maintain what turns out to be a mechanically favorable ratio between the main constituent materials. Maybe we can get some notion about how these tiles are actually increasing in size by looking at their structure a little bit more. This is a cross-section of the uncalcified cartilage here. These are tesserae on top. If we zoom in on one of those, all of these things that look like little black-eyed peas inside are living cells. And you see it's just absolutely full of living cells. A more zoomed-in view in an SEM preparation, all the white material here is mineralized. Here's a chondrocyte. Here's a second one here, connected by short passages. So if we take a CT volume here, a synchrotron tomogram, and remove all the mineral, you see that this is a cartilaginous system, mineralized cartilaginous system, with a huge density of cells on the inside. So it looks similar to some of the stuff that Ron was showing. How it's actually maintaining this high density is an interesting thing. If we just take a view at the bottom of a tessera here, it's sitting on top of the uncalcified cartilage. If you look across ontogeny, across the age range of an animal, what you see is that chondrocytes up against the bottom of the tesserae gradually just get gathered up by the mineral, so that eventually you end up with these systems where the tessera is effectively advancing over the cells that are arranged next to it. As a result, then, you end up with these cell-rich laminations where the cells are still communicating to one another. What's particularly weird about this, I mean, this looks, when I showed you that tomogram, it looks quite similar to what Ron was showing. We need to keep in mind that this is cartilage. So if you look at cartilage adjacent to bone, normally, as the cartilage cells are getting closer to the tide mark area where the tissue is mineralizing, all the cells are dying, such to the point that if you look at the cell density in unmineralized cartilage here and compare it to mineralized cartilage, it may be reduced by about 80% or up to 100% as the tissue is mineralizing. After that tissue has been moved away, the mineralized cartilage has been replaced by bone, the cell density in bone is higher, but still not as high as in unmineralized cartilage. That's for humans. If I map that across all other mammals for which I can find data, it's the same basic story. You have a higher cell density in cartilage, it gets reduced as the cartilage is converted to bone. What's different here, though, is that there's no density in cell, no change in cell density between unmineralized and mineralized cartilage. So effectively, this is a material that's simply mineralizing. There appears to be no major change in terms of cell death or anything along those lines. We still don't know what's actually causing, what's regulating that mineralization, but you can see if you just look at a backscatter image here, all these black spaces are where the cells would live. We see these concentric patterns, really pretty patterns of mineral density variation around the cells to make it seem like they might be somehow involved in regulating the mineral, or at least keeping it from encroaching. Okay, just some other nice views of tesserae. All of these are backscatter images. And again, you see a huge range of mineral density variation. That mineral density variation actually also relates to material property variation. Here's a cross-section of a skeleton and backscatter. This would be uncalcified cartilage on the inside. These are the tesserae on the outside. If we zoom in on one pair of tesserae here, this is a side view, and you see again this mineral density variation. If I just convert that to a color map of grayscale values and then compare that to a nanoindentation map of modulus, we see a strong correlation between these hotter areas of high mineral density relates to high modulus. We pair that also with scanning acoustic microscopy measurements, and again, there's a nice pairing between the modulus and the reflectivity of the tissue. But using those modulus data, we can actually then convert these to values of tissue density. We see those same correlations I was talking about before. High mineral density equals high tissue density equals high modulus. What's interesting about this, I think, though, is we can revisit this material space now. Here's the density of tissues. Here's the Young's modulus. Here's bone. Here's unmineralized cartilage, like I showed you before. If I take the values from some acellular fish bone that Ron and I have gathered and compare it with a few data I can find on tissue density for fish bone and also for stingray mineralized cartilage, what you're seeing is that these tissues, although they have a similar stiffness to the bone of mammals, they're shifted left in terms of their density. So we have tissues here that are just a little bit more dense than the bodies of the fishes themselves and a little bit more dense than the water that they're in, but comparatively low density for their stiffnesses. We can also do the same thing of putting our material onto a material space, in this case one for mechanical damping capability versus modulus, was sort of a difficult to attain promised land, being this upper right corner where you have high stiffness and high damping. Through preliminary data, percussion testing, impact testing of the different components of this tissue, you see that uncalcified cartilage, as you might expect, has a high mechanical damping capability. Tesserae, on the other hand, lower damping, higher stiffness. By combining the two of those, we end up with a tissue that kind of functions as the best of both worlds tissue that's in an ideal range of that curve. So we've talked a little bit about the individual components, but also you need to keep in mind that the arrangement of this tesseral mat, the arrangement of the tissues in space, the architecture can be important as well. We took three different blocks of tissue, all exactly the same size, and tested them in three orientations. Unmineralized cartilage here, a block of unmineralized cartilage with tesserae on top, loaded normally to the material, and then turned 90 degrees so that the load is applied within the plane of the mat. With those orientations, we then performed stress relaxation studies. And as you can see here, these icons here relate to these individual testing conditions. In parallel loading, so as long as the load is within the plane of the mat, the tissue is considerably stiffer. It takes longer to relax, as you might expect. But if you're loading perpendicular to that mat, the tissue, even if it has tesserae on top, they behave essentially like the non-tessellated cartilage, like an unmineralized cartilage. The problem is that we don't really know too much about in the animals about how that layer of tesserae is arranged and how it relates to what the animals are doing. We know far less than we do for bone. Peter mentioned Wolf's Law a little bit yesterday, but we have plenty of nice data for bone showing that the cross-sectional shape of the bone relates to, for instance, the ecology of different animals, how the bones are loaded, what the history of the bone is. Cartilaginous skeletons, we know very little about this, but we do have a nice context that I think is useful to look in, and that's in terms of the jaws of sharks and rays. This is a CT scan of upper and lower jaw with the teeth segmented out. And for, in terms of the jaws, these are some of the few structures for which we know something about the loads that the animals are exerting and experiencing. What is nice then is then it allows us to maybe apply some concepts of beam theory to ask how differences in material properties and differences in geometry might relate to the way the tissues are used. So those concepts of beam theory are much easier if we're looking at relatively simple shapes. And you notice that if you CT scan a block of tesseral tissue here, this rind on the outside, and here's another view from a slightly lower resolution scan, the rind on the outside essentially forms a tube with a hollow center. The hollow center would be the uncalcified cartilage, but it's not showing up in the CT scan. So what this allows us to do then is take those cross sections, examine them in terms of a range of geometric properties relating to how they respond to load, and then, for instance, plot that according to a range of cross sections working our way down the jaw and compare those among a variety of species. So for one thing that we, this one study that we did, we took a very closely related group of fishes. These are all part of the same family, but the difference is that they're hugely variable in size. This is a basking shark compared to a crocodile shark here. And also their diets are insanely different. You have white sharks in here that are eating seals. You have filter feeding sharks. But from these, we could get an idea of how the tissue is actually laid out by CT scanning all their jaws, isolating the upper and lower jaws, and then performing geometric morphometrics about their the cross sections of the tissue. And what we find, there are many trends tied up in this, but the one that turns out to be relatively consistent, regardless of size of animal, regardless of diet, is the fact that up towards the rostral end of the jaws, in the lower jaw and the upper jaw, the cross sections tend to suggest some sort of isotropic loading regime. The aspect ratios of the cross sections tend to be more rounded, whereas as you get further towards the area of the back of the jaw, where the jaw joint is, where the muscle attachments are, we see extremely anisotropic cross sections of the tissue. Now, take that back to those data we had before showing that the orientation of the tissue actually plays a role. In those areas where we have very anisotropic cross sections, not only are we having tissue that's arranged in a way to increase the second moment of area for a very limited loading regime, but also you see that the vast majority of the tesserae here are arranged in a way so that the loading would be in plane. So arranged in a way so that you can maximize the stiffness of this type of material. So just for the last step, so we've talked a bit about the arrangement of tissue, the properties of individual components. What we'd like to do next is really look at the tiling of the tissue and how that relates to performance. This is something that I could never get at before. Trying to map out tesserae in 3D on a sample would just be an absolute nightmare. But working with these people at the Sousa Institute, we're taking CT scans and we're able to isolate individual tesserae. And then from that, hopefully get an idea of some of the tiling rules, how that relates to radii of curvature of the surface, how the tesserae are interacting, and how that varies across different animals and different structures. So hopefully I've convinced you that this is an interesting composite tissue. It has an interesting range of material and biological properties, but we can't forget to sort of plug it back into the context of the animal. And by doing this, we maybe even learn something a little more about the animals themselves. Here's a track of a white shark that was tagged off the coast of California and then took the wise choice to head towards Hawaii. over about 3 months, it traveled nearly 4,000 kilometers. And if we just do a back of the napkin calculation to figure out how many times it had to wag its tail to get there, then expand that over the approximate lifetime of the fish, we see that this cartilaginous skeleton, remember a cartilage can't heal, is cycled a huge number of times throughout the animal's life. So in addition to these interesting properties, it might also be that there's some sort of fatigue resistance or fatigue avoidance built into the tissue that we have yet to appreciate. It certainly would make sense given the ecologies of the animals. So there are plenty more questions to ask at a variety of size scales. I think from the biological standpoint, this question of how we maintain zones of mineralized tissue and non-mineralized tissue in specific areas and so close to each other is extremely interesting. But at a larger size scale, are these questions we're getting into now of tiling and how that relates to performance, I think could really provide reasonable inroads for biomimetics in that it could be that some of the interesting performance we're seeing for the tissue can actually be largely understood at this size scale, at the more architectural size scale, rather than small variations in, say, mineral density and material properties at lower size scales. So, thanks for your attention. Thank you.